Welcome to the What's Your Ethos podcast, where we interview the leaders from insurance carriers, distributors, and insurtechs tackling some of the thorniest issues in the industry. Hi, I'm Peter Colas, the CEO of Ethos. Today we have with us Brooks Tingle. Brooks is the CEO of John Hancock, which is one of the oldest and largest life insurers in the U.S. They support millions of Americans with a broad range of financial products, which include life insurance and annuities. And in addition to being a great leader, Brooks is also a champion of using life insurance to help policyholders live a longer and a better life. I'm so glad we could do this, Brooks. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Peter. Super happy to be here with you today.
So, Brooks, most of our listeners are at a life carrier or a distributor. Can you tell us about John Hancock? What are your core products, your general business strategy, how you go to market, key differentiators from a product and a distribution standpoint?
Sure. Happy to. And as you mentioned, we've been around for a while. We're a 162-year-old company, and there's a whole bunch of really positive stuff that comes with that. We're resilient. We're financially strong. We're trusted. But, you know, frankly, it's not enough just to be an old, reliable company. I firmly believe that we must marry all the best things of being a 162-year-old company with the leading edge of innovation. In a bunch of important ways. The ways that we tend to focus on innovation are in the realm that you mentioned, helping people live longer, healthier, better lives. It struck me a few years ago that it's beyond irrational that a life insurance company wouldn't try to help their customers live longer. Seems like it would make a lot of sense. So we're very, very passionate about that and drive a lot of innovation around that. I'm sure we'll discuss. Also very, very enthusiastic about innovation around the buying process. I think life insurance historically has been among the most difficult products to purchase in the modern digital economy, and not many people get a lot of joy out of owning life insurance. You combine those two fun facts, really hard to buy, not so fun to own, doesn't really feel like a winning formula, again, in a modern digital economy. So I'm really trying to drive a lot of innovation around that, you know, focused on our great relationships with independent third-party advisors, and of course, wonderful partners now like you at Ethos, Peter.
That's great to hear. So before we turn our focus to John Hancock, how did you initially get into the business of protecting families? What's your journey into life insurance?
Yeah, I would say for any of you that have young kids in college or whatever that don't know precisely what they want to do, give them a break, because I had no clue what I wanted to do, even when I stumbled out of undergrad. Honestly, even out of grad school, I wasn't entirely sure. So I started at John Hancock, and yes, I've been with one brand my entire career. I say brand versus company, because John Hancock was acquired by Manulife Financial 20 years ago now, and we're a rather different company, a truly global company and a wonderful company, much larger. But one brand my whole career, which I think is, well, some people say it makes me a dinosaur. Some people say it makes me a unicorn. I don't know, but it's unique. I started really deep in sort of the back office of what we do as an insurance company. And I honestly wouldn't trade it for anything. I had a chance to start in different parts of the company and actually kind of chose to start in what we called operations at the time, sort of customer service, processing claims, working with advisors to make sure they got paid the right commission. And those experiences of working directly with policyholders, beneficiaries, agents, advisors, I wouldn't trade for anything, because as an executive at an insurance company or any company, it's easy to kind of look at data about customers as numbers and policy numbers and the number of policyholders you have. And I just had some amazing experiences early in my career of talking to real people. And sometimes at the worst moments of their life, having lost a loved one, sometimes at a better moment, but really shaped who I am and the value that I see in our products and services.
It's awesome to hear how that prepared you to be a great leader of the company. When you reflect back to your career journey throughout John Hancock, what were some of the toughest roles you took on with some of the biggest obstacles you had to overcome on your journey to get here?
Yeah, certainly a tough moment, I will say, was 9/11, 2001. It was really a defining moment for me in terms of, I had kind of understood the role our solutions play in people's lives, but to get calls I personally signed off on every 9/11 claim we paid. I think we paid 104 claims from 9/11, and read deeply into every individual story. And they were just amazingly compelling stories, tragic stories, of course. Equally impactful were instances I experienced where someone called and said, please tell me my spouse has life insurance with you. I know they were thinking about buying it. I think they applied. They were killed in the World Trade Center yesterday. And it'll make the whole difference, all the difference in the world to my family if that life insurance is in effect. And to have to say, sorry, they hadn't gone through the process or what have you. So just so many lessons learned out of such a great, a terrible moment of tragedy. Just that those experiences of seeing the best of what our solutions can do and just those worst times when somebody dies unexpectedly without the protection and the heartbreaking discussions of, sorry, there isn't life insurance there. So that was very a formative moment for me. I would say in terms of day-to-day challenges, by far it has been to drive the kind of innovation that we need to drive. And Peter, I commend you. You and your firm have been doing this from really inception, but only the most charitable observer would describe the insurance industry as having been innovative over its hundreds of years of history. And I believe very, very strongly that we must be innovative. We must be more digital. We must be easier to work with. We must be more relatable today's consumer, both in terms of the value of our solutions and all the processes around them, buying them, servicing, and so forth. And there have been many points of pretty radical innovation we've undertaken. We have a solution called Vitality. We may talk about that offers clients a nifty app and a series of incentives and rewards to take steps that correlate with a longer, healthier life. People told me, oh, that'll never get approved by regulators, or you can't do that. You can't do that for all these reasons. And very pleased to say that it's coming up on our 10th anniversary. More recently, I just happened to see a story on NBC Nightly News about a company called Grail and a test called the Gallery test, which through a simple blood draw, it can detect the presence of over 50 types of cancer in our body. This isn't a predictive thing like, geez, Perks is more likely to get some cancer someday. It's like, is it in your body right now? And I thought, geez, as a life insurance company, 36% of our customers are going to get cancer. Doesn't it make sense for us to try to help them find out early when it's much more treatable? And people told me, oh, you'll never be able to figure out how to offer that to policyholders. And I'm very gratified to say that we've been offering it to our Vitality policyholders for almost 2 years and now have literally dozens of people, of customers who said, John Hancock saved my life. That had I not taken that test. Just last week, I heard from somebody who said they discovered they had stage 1 throat cancer by virtue of taking that test because they're a John Hancock policyholder. So anyway, some of those bigger types of innovation aren't easy in our industry, but can be done and are both sort of the biggest challenge, but also the biggest gratification and reward when you accomplish them.
So, and I'm excited to talk about all the ways that you guys are innovating, but if you just step back, so John Hancock is 162 years old. You probably write close to $500 million a year of new life premiums. You're a major player in IUL and other product categories. When you think about what have really been the keys to your success and longevity as a company, what really defines the John Hancock difference? And how have you built such an iconic brand, which is just known to, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ingredients there. I take pride in being a 162-year-old company because there aren't a lot of companies that endure that long, let alone thrive. We've never been stronger. So I don't mean to minimize that, but I'm probably not the most proud of simply the fact that we've been around for 162 years. And again, I don't mean to minimize that because you have an incredible institutional knowledge. During COVID, people said, oh, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Well, it wasn't for us institutionally. We were paying claims during the Spanish flu in 1917, and we've seen multiple world wars. So you've kind of seen it all. And from a financial resilience perspective and things like that, you know, there is real value there. So I don't mean to minimize that. But I'm much more proud of, and I think John Hancock is much more defined by, our unique mission and purpose, which is seeing what I think every insurer should see, which is we're on the same side as our customer. Too often people see insurance as a bet between the individual and the insurance company. I see it just the opposite, that most all of us desire to live a long, healthy, good life, right? Well, guess what? Your life insurance company, Peter, really wants you to live a long, healthy life too. You know how we make money, of course, right? You're kind enough to pay us premiums. We invest those premiums. The longer we're able to collect and invest those premiums before we pay a claim, the more money we make. So there's this wonderful alignment of interest. And having that at the core of our mission and purpose is, to me, what defines Hancock, at least in the modern era, building on all those strengths of our history with the leading edge of innovation, offering our customers. You know, when the Apple Watch first came out, we started offering customer Apple Watches. Then there was this test called the Gallery Test by Grail. We just last week announced a partnership with a company called Prenuvo, who does full body imaging. Our customers enjoy a discount on that and front of the line access to that. So the notion of just constantly bringing to our customers the latest, greatest science, technology, information that's going to help them live a longer, healthier life is what, to me, separates us. We have wonderfully innovative product designs across a broad portfolio of products. We've got great underwriting. We've got a great distribution team. We've got a lot of things, but that notion of being on the same side as your customer is what resonates most with me. And Peter, frankly, every CEO, every company says, oh, we've got our customer's best interest at heart, don't we? You know what? Frankly, I don't always believe that. I'm sure somewhere they want that to be true. But if you actually watch how some companies behave, how some industries behave, it's not clear that there's that alignment. In our industry and for our company, we're purely aligned in the outcomes that we want to achieve. And that's just amazing to me.
So, Brooks, I agree. I think you've probably done more to align the interests of the insurance company with the policyholder than anyone else in the industry. And I really appreciate what you've done. If you go back to 10 years ago before you started Vitality, and you think back to those first conversations that you had maybe with your actuarial team and your finance team, and you said, hey, we want to start giving people the opportunity to reduce their annual premium. We want to start adding, at the time, what will be perceived as costs, whether it's an Apple Watch or a gallery test, which I think is around $1,000 to a consumer buying. You probably have purchasing power in it. Prenuvo test, I think, is around $2,000 to a consumer. It's a major bet as to if it's going to produce better than baseline mortality to justify these costs. How did you guys get comfortable with the decision? Because it's a bold bet that probably took a while to, you know, matriculate and prove if it was a good business decision or not.
Yeah, it wasn't as difficult as you might think for a couple of reasons. One, this concept exists and existed even 10 years ago in many other parts of insurance. Many people are familiar with, through your employer, you might have the opportunity to participate in a wellness program where if you do certain things, your health insurance premium goes down by a few hundred dollars. There are reasons, by the way, that I think that type of thing makes a lot more sense with life insurance and health insurance. I'll talk about it in a moment. But auto insurance, it's been more than 10 years that there have been these safe driving programs, right? You're willing to put a telematics device in your car, and if you're a safe driver, you pay less. So this notion of the real concept, Peter, that I heard of at the time and has always stuck with me is, as an insurance company, you have a choice. You can be one of two things. You can be a passive claims payer, issue policies and sit back and wait to pay the claim, passive claims payer, or an active risk manager, where you engage your customers and try to shape the long-term outcomes. The latter sounds a whole lot more fun to me and a whole lot more rewarding to me. And you actually see it in almost every other type of insurance, industrial, property and casualty insurance. If you and I were running a big factory somewhere, we'd get a discount on our P&C insurance for our big machines in our plant if we had sensors that said if they're overheating or not, or if there's been a flood or not. So this notion of you know, the Internet of Things and sort of shared value and is really powerful. And I was surprised, honestly, it hadn't come to life insurance. Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't come more than it has. So, and life insurance is the perfect setting for it, as I mentioned, because people kind of, I don't know, people have mixed feelings about wellness programs through their employer. Some skepticism of, I don't want my employer knowing how healthy I am or not, but they actually have sort of mixed economic track records. But the big difference between there and life insurance is that the average employee stays with the company now about 4-point-something years. So if you're a health insurer or an employer looking to invest in making Peter or Brooks more healthy and living a longer, healthier life, you've got this really short window. You're making these investments, but some of those investments won't pay off for decades. Well, in our business, Peter, as you know, our relationships average decades long. And it wasn't all that long ago. I remember paying a claim where the client had been a client for 99 years.
Wow.
Parents bought the kid a policy on his first birthday. He died shortly after his 100th birthday. But adult lifelong relationships are common in our industry. So if we can engage our customers, we don't need to turn everyone into a marathon runner. I'm surely not running marathons, Peter. Maybe you are, but I'm surely not. But I'm able to reach the highest status in our programs by being diligent about screenings and physical activity and things like that. And if we can help our population of customers just be a bit better, not every customer, but as a population, more physically active, a bit more conscious of nutrition, going for preventative screenings, it pays off massively. And then we take those economic gains and use it to fuel the program. So it wasn't really that big of a bet. The science, the interesting thing about longevity is the science is quite clear about, you know, none of us can control the exact date of our demise, but well over half the deaths in the U.S. now are from so-called lifestyle diseases, where choices we make every single day, you know, what we eat, do we exercise or not, do we smoke, how much do we drink, do we go see our docs or not, those all shape our risks of dying from one of these lifestyle diseases. So there's never been a better time. Then you marry technology, like from an Apple Watch or other devices with it. It's never been easier to sort of incentivize, motivate, reward people for doing those things. So anyways, that was a long answer, but it wasn't. And I thankfully at the time we had a board that just kind of got it. Like, again, if you have a choice in life between being a passive claims payer or active risk manager, I think most people would say I'd rather be an active risk manager.
It makes sense. And it's impressive that you were probably able to overcome over organizational inertia at the time to actually execute on it, rally the team, and build a culture around just aligning these incentives. And my guess is it's been a massive boom to the team's culture and energy and enthusiasm about what they do in the industry and how they're changing the industry.
Yeah, completely agree. I'm a huge believer from a leadership perspective. And Peter, I admire your leadership at Ethos. It's been very powerful. But I'm a huge believer that no good result, truly impressive result, happens absent a compelling and powerful vision about where you want to go and a mission. And to be honest with you, if people can't get excited about helping people live longer, healthier, better lives, what can you get excited about, right? Like, it's a whole lot more exciting than just issuing policies and waiting for a claim to come in. And, you know, everybody's got a personal connection to it. Peter, my mom never smoked a cigarette in her life, was not feeling well for a couple of years. Nobody ever thought to look for lung cancer because she was a non-smoker. I finally got her to the right place. And within 3 days, they diagnosed her with late stage lung cancer. And she was dead within 8 months because she was diagnosed so late. So it's kind of a personal thing for me. And everybody has a story, something like that, right? A friend or a family member where with a different sort of intervention or early detection, there could have been a very different outcome. So it's hugely powerful as a motivator for us to push through the difficult things, whether it's, you know, potential regulatory barrier. By the way, I think regulators get a bad rap. Everyone says, well, regulators, insurance companies have blamed regulators for not innovating. I've actually found regulators to be quite open to innovation if you can explain it, if there's science behind it, it's not a gimmick and so forth. But anyways, lots of excuses for not innovating, but having that powerful mission and purpose pushes you through that hard work. Frankly, gives us an advantage with attracting and retaining talent, creating high engagement levels, things like that.
That makes sense, Brooks. So I'm curious, you know, when you look at Grail's Galleri multi-cancer early detection test, when you look at Prenuvo's MRI scans, both of these are really powerful tools attacking early cancer detection, which we've all been reading about is early onset cancer is just on the rise in a big way. I've been reading articles saying it's up 80%, 90% for early onset colon cancer from 2 decades ago. And many other types of cancers. No one really can isolate what's causing these things, but something in our life has clearly changed about it. I'm curious to hear, how did you think about focusing on cancer detection as, you know, something to go really, really deep on when you think about, you know, what's going to shift that baseline mortality? And then I'm curious, when you think about the future, what else is really interesting? Do you see John Hancock one day being able to, you know, contribute to, you know, making GLP-1 costs more affordable to clients? How else are you thinking about expanding the program in the future?
Yeah, brilliant question. And you're questions exactly along the lines of our strategy and our mission and purpose, which is whatever the latest, greatest then technology is, we're going to be bringing it to our customers. We're going to be researching it. We're going to be talking to the people behind it. And when it's ready, bringing it to our customers. So the key thing is, you know, whether it's the Galleri test by Grail, Prenuvo scan that we now offer our customers, you know, no one of them is perfect. And not a single executive at any one of those companies would say our test is perfect. But what they do is improve odds. And I kind of view, for myself, I kind of stack these on top of each other. So I do the Grail test every year, right on the 1 year anniversary of having done it, because that test is quite interesting. They'll tell you that not only does it get more reliable at the population level, the more people do it, but it gets more accurate for you or me each time you or me take the test. So I now have three under my belt and I tend to take it every year because it'll get better and better for me. But it's not perfect. They would tell you that. There are false positives and there are false negatives. Now, I will say that I'll take the risk of a false positive or a false negative because most of those 50-some types of cancer that they're looking for, there is no routine screening for. On the day I take Galleri each year, my pancreas isn't getting scanned looking for pancreatic cancer. We've had multiple customers find out they have stage 2 pancreatic cancer from our offer. And that's like a winning lottery ticket. When do you hear of pancreatic cancer being described, diagnosed at stage 2?
Never.
I mentioned the stage 1 throat cancer last week. Just constantly these stories. We have a video out on our website now, a customer who discovered he had stage 2 cancer. He said he'd never felt better in his life, would have never believed that he had cancer. Happened to be a John Hancock Vitality customer, took the test and found out that he had cancer. He's going through treatment now. So that's really popular now. The Prenuvo test, again, in and of itself, you wouldn't want to go through it and say, oh, I had a clean scan. I'm certified, you know, 100% healthy, because it looks for like 70% of mortality factors, I would say. But you start stacking these things on top of each other, in addition to the traditional screenings of, you know, colonoscopy when you're supposed to, you know, if you're a woman, the mammograms when you're supposed to, other types of preventative care. So to me, the future is about prevention and early detection. And you look at the stats on cancer, we were so excited about these types of tests we're talking about now, because cancer is one where early detection can, doesn't always, but can typically mean everything. Survivability rates of like 8x caught at stage 1 or 2 versus 3 or 4. And so from our business perspective, again, over a third of our customers are going to get cancer. We want them to find out early when the result is better. But just from a human perspective, I mentioned my mom, like I think all the time, if this test had been around, maybe she would have known 2 years earlier that she indeed had lung cancer. So both from a personal sort of values perspective, but GLP-1s, I think, are fascinating. We're actively studying that now. We haven't yet announced anything, but you're 100% right. There are a lot of people in America who probably would benefit a great deal from GLP-1s, but can't yet access them, either through their health insurance or they're prohibitively expensive if health insurance won't cover them. Should we be playing a role in helping people access those types of things? Because they appear to be. I'm not a doctor, but every smart person I talk to talks about them being a game changer as it relates to, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes, and things like that. So that's all the stuff that we're in the thick of and we'll just constantly be bringing to our customers.
That makes sense. You know, you've talked about how you're really innovating in aligning incentives between John Hancock and your policyholders. Can you talk also about how you've focused on innovating in the purchase process and making life insurance more accessible to a broader range of clients and just increasing your, you know, net promoter score and making clients love the brand?
Yeah. Great question, Peter. I think, you know, I said that about 10 years ago when we started on this journey, we realized that we were offering a product that was really hard to buy and not at all fun to own. I think we've addressed a lot of the fun to own part through Vitality. If you look at word clouds from customers that participate in Vitality, fun is actually one of the more common words. There are games within Vitality, like a Wheel of Fortune type thing you spin and you can win $5 at Starbucks or $10 at Amazon. And it's funny, people will be saving thousands of dollars on their premium, but the thing they enjoy the most is like the $5 gift card at Starbucks gift card or something. But anyways, so we made it much more fun to own. We've gone from interacting with our policyholders once or twice a year when we send them a bill or a privacy notice to 20 to 30 times a month when they're getting a discount at the grocery store. All of our customers get 25% off purchases of fresh fruits and vegetables at over 60,000 grocery stores. And when they write at the cash register on the receipt, It'll say, you know, $5 bag of apples minus $1.25 John Hancock Vitality. So it's just a fun, you know, pleasing way to be a part of our customers' lives when otherwise they wouldn't think very favorably about their life insurance company. So huge progress on the fund to own. Easy to buy, much more ahead of us. And I think it's probably the number one imperative facing our industry is making our solutions easier to access, easier to buy. I would seriously argue, and you probably heard me joke about this, Peter, that I don't think there's a product left in the modern economy that's more difficult to buy than life insurance. I joke that buying a home is kind of complicated, but your realtor doesn't ask you for your blood and urine. Yeah. And we have got to simplify this process. And you know what? The ability to do so is right at our fingertips. With electronic health records, I mean, my vision is that within 2 years, we simply ask somebody for their name, birth date, and a one-time consent to access electronic medical information, and we come back with a price within moments to hours, not many weeks as it can sometimes. You guys have done some good innovation to speed the process up, and others of us are trying as well, but there needs to be radical. For a long time in our industry, people would celebrate, hey, the life insurance application has gone from 31 pages to 26 pages. Yay, you know, we've cut it by 15%. Well, you know, how do we get it to like three questions, right? And then we do the work. So I think that's right at the doorstep. These things never happen as fast as I think they should, or probably as you think they should, Peter, but they are going to happen. The technology is there for us to be able to price people's insurance risk much less invasively, much more quickly than we have in the past and than we do today.
So I love that you've spent your career at one company. I think a lot of people think that by jumping from company to company, they'll advance more into more interesting opportunities. But to me, the ability to amortize all the relationships that you've built, all the deep, deep knowledge of the industry and how that company works and what makes it special is a really strategic thing to do, especially if you're at the right company that has the right bones in making of a great career. One of the kind of probably pivotal moments in this career is John Hancock before Manulife acquired it and after Manulife acquired it. Tell us, how has the company changed since that happened? Because you've had a firsthand, you know, seat at it.
Yeah, John Hancock was a great company before Manulife acquired us. I would say it's an even better company after. Better in so far as a true global insurance powerhouse. Top three Pan-Asian insurer, dominant presence in Canada, and leading presence in many markets in the U.S. through John Hancock. So it's fascinating to be an executive with a truly global company like that. The ability to export some of our ideas here in the U.S. and import other markets. Frankly, there are markets in Asia that are just way ahead of the U.S. in terms of digital adoption and enablement and being able to import some of that thinking. So being part of a truly global company, just the size and the scale of Manulife gives us a lot of benefits. The diversification of being part of we have four major segments within Manulife: U.S., Canada, Asia, and our global wealth and asset management franchise. And it's pretty cool where any one quarter, maybe one segment's off a little bit, but the other three are doing well. Like during COVID, Asia was a bit more locked down than some places. Right. And then, as has happened the last couple quarters, when all four segments, you know, sort of over-deliver, it's a wonderful thing, you know, for our investors and so forth. So it's quite a great company. And you know, the Hancock brand is still very strong. My view of leading John Hancock within Manulife is the more valuable Hancock is as a brand, as a company, the more valuable thing that Manulife owns. And John Hancock itself is more valuable through its association and ownership from Manulife, the global scale and expertise that we're able to tap into. So it's been quite a great experience. And I would say to folks, you know, it's worked for me to stay with one brand my whole career, but I've had the opportunity to kind of jump around into different functions. You know, I led everything from operations to IT to marketing, you know, before leading the whole business. I would caution against staying in one company doing the same thing for 30 years. I mean, if it makes you happy, you should do it. People should do whatever makes them happy. But I probably stayed a little too long in certain parts of the company that I just enjoyed. Once I went over to marketing and some other things, I'm like, oh, wow, this is a whole nother part of the business. So, yeah. And then now when Manulife acquired us, being able to get that global exposure is just so compelling. It's just fascinating to see what the insurance market's like in Vietnam and things like that. So it's really kind of what you make of it and what the company is and who they are in terms of whether staying with one company makes sense or not. But for me, it's been a blessing.
And when I think about the major U.S. carriers that are part of an international larger parent company like John Hancock, Allianz, Legal & General, is there a big advantage from a portfolio management standpoint as well and the returns that you can generate for policyholders and for investors?
I haven't really thought about it that way. I mean, we're very proud of, I think scale gives you benefits for sure. Tapping into the investment management expertise of a truly global player, being able to pursue truly global investments. You see the power of that kind of diversification when you see like commercial real estate stumbling a bit, particularly in the U.S. You know, our commercial real estate holdings are diversified across U.S., Canada, Asia, and different patterns there. Certainly, I think the global association is powerful. But I think every company is different. You know, I sometimes get involved in these, what I think are ridiculous debates about mutual companies versus stock companies. And I think it's ridiculous because, you know, I've been part of a mutual company, I've been part of a stock company, and I have friends that run all of them. And there's nothing inherent to the DNA of either a mutual or a stock company that makes one better than the other. You have to get to know the leadership of the company, understand the DNA of the company. Because you can say, well, gee, our structure means we're on the same side as our customer. Well, we're a stock company. And I would tell you, I challenge anybody to say that their company does more on the same side of their customer to help their customers live longer, healthier, better lives. And you know, frankly, there are mutual companies I'd be happy to work with as a consumer and ones I wouldn't, and stock companies I would and wouldn't. So I don't get too into those broad generalizations. You really kind of study the company and study the leadership.
That makes sense. So all insurance companies are data companies. Some have better or less access to that data and more or less ability to influence and change their processes and business with that data. But AI is, you know, a profound opportunity, I think, for the insurance category overall. I'm curious, have you found any opportunities for generative AI to enhance your business? Do you see any meaningful opportunities in the future coming that could change how you guys operate as a business or change how the industry operates?
100%. And we are, we're very fortunate to have more data than the typical insurance company about our customers that we're very transparent with the customers, by the way. It's funny, when we started Vitality, people said, well, geez, I don't know if customers are going to want to share this data with you. We had a three-pronged approach there. We said, one, totally voluntary. If you don't participate in Vitality, you don't lose anything. It's all carrots, no sticks. You can only gain things. Two, we're completely transparent about what we do and don't do with the data. We're not selling it. We're not giving it away. We're not doing these different things. And three, what people love is that we're very clear about what you get back in return for sharing your data. Because most people, Peter, most of us know that companies have a bunch of data about us and we don't exactly know what they have or how they're using it other than I get weirdly sort of half correctly targeted ads and things. But we say to customers, hey, if you're willing to share with us, you know, how many steps you take a day or the results of your last blood pressure reading or what have you, here's what you get in return. You can get up to a 25% discount on your life insurance. You can get an Amazon Prime membership. You can get 50% off hotel stays through Expedia. And the idea of consumers sort of monetizing their data has been very appealing. But anyway, so there's nothing secret about us having this data. Now, the key is we have only one objective with how we use that data, and that's to promote this mission and purpose about helping people live longer, healthier, better lives. And you could see how we might do that with advanced analytics and ultimately AI and things like that, where personalization is the name of the game, right? Like, I guarantee you, you and I have a different primary barrier keeping us from living a long, healthy life. Mine is I don't sleep very well. I won't ascribe an affliction to you, Peter. You probably don't have many, but there's something that probably could be better if you want to live a long, healthy life. But they're different. And if you took 20 people in a room, most people would have a different journey. So how do we leverage the data that we have to offer customers more personalized discounts, incentives, rewards, tools and technology to promote that journey? AI, I think, can be enormous benefit as it relates to customer service, customer self-service. We talked about the buying process. I think it can be brought to bear to simplify the buying process. So I'm excited about it. I think we, like others, are moving cautiously with Gen AI. responsibly, I guess is the word I would use, to make sure that everything is done with the utmost accuracy and so forth. But I do see a lot of potential there.
So Brooks, when you look at the industry historically, accessibility to life insurance has been a pressing concern. How do you envision the industry being able to address this issue of reaching underserved markets and then creating, you know, products that are accessible to these markets so that people of any background can protect their family and make sure that the family is cared for when that family is in the most vulnerable state?
This is a hugely important issue, Peter, not just for me as a leader in an industry, but I think the entire industry. That, like any complicated issue, there's not one single silver bullet here. There are a couple things that have to happen. One is, as I've indicated earlier, we must radically simplify the purchase process. We have many, many great insurance advisors in the U.S., but you know, they're practical with their time, and they tend to gravitate towards more affluent customers because, frankly, our industry is one of the few where we ask the salesperson to not only make the sale, but then participate in the manufacturing process by going through this clunky new business and underwriting process, gathering up requirements, filling out the long app, holding people's hands through this many times multiple week process. So people are all, at the end of the day, economically rational. And a lot of advisors say, gosh, it's not worth my time to spend the number of hours that it will take to write a, you know, a $400,000 term policy on a 33-year-old woman who maybe just had a child or something. So if we can simplify that buying process, though, where it is as simple as, I found a client, they've got a need, I've identified the need, let's fulfill the need. And it's literally more like dropping a ticket or something rather than this burdensome process. I think that'll have advisors open to spending more time with a broader cross-section of clients is one. There are lots of people that our industry has underserved historically. One of the things that I'm most proud of, though it hasn't totally gotten traction, that we've done is a product called John Hancock Aspire, which is the first life insurance built for people living with diabetes. And yep, it has personalized pathways and discounts and rewards and a support program for people living with diabetes. Half of people living with diabetes in America, and you know as well as I, the explosion in the number of people living with diabetes in the U.S., it's only projected to grow and grow. We surveyed them, and half of them think that they can't get life insurance. But in reality, if you look at, of all the people living with diabetes that applied for life insurance, something like 90% of it, 90% of them ultimately get covered. But there's this perception that, oh, I can't get covered. So we need to get to people and say, not only if you happen to have a chronic condition, can you get life insurance, but we're designing solutions that are for just you. Now, the thing that we've got to work on is we've got to make the underwriting process, again, it all comes back to more welcoming, more simple, to let people in there. So a bunch of things like that. So I think a lot of the investments in digital, use of electronic health records, simplifying it both for the end customer and for the advisor. I think it's for the foreseeable future, this is still going to be an advice-driven, you know, agent broker-driven business. You know, as much as we've seen people talk about direct-to-consumer, it's like the same percentage of sales it was 15 years ago in our industry. And I'm a huge believer in the power of advice. Even when somebody can understand something themselves, there's real power for me sitting across from you, Peter, and me saying, hey, Peter, I think I've got the right amount. I make this much money. Here's the amount of insurance. And you looking me in the eye and say, yeah, Brooks, you've got that right. Why don't we just add this? Like that, it's the kind of space that people need that. But we need to make it all just so much more simple. And I think we can get advisors focused on more people, let people with different conditions know that they're eligible, easier to get, and have them see the value that life insurance isn't just, for most of the industry's history, life insurance has almost been an act of, I don't know, not generosity, but it's an act for someone else. You know, in the past, I had life insurance so that if I get hit by a car tonight, you know, my kids will be able to go to college or what have you. Yeah. By making life insurance what it is today at John Hancock, helping you live a longer, healthier, better life, there's as much in it for me as the purchaser, the discounts at the grocery store, the value of the preventative screenings. as it is, as there is for my heirs. So by making it more relevant to the buyer, the act of buying life insurance is we're all kind of self-motivated in a way. I hate to say it. I'm getting something out of it personally, not just the peace of mind that my family will be okay if something happens. So anyway, this is a long answer, but it's a really important issue for us to tackle. And I think honestly, Peter, you know, Ethos has been a big part of that. And, you know, we look forward to continue to collaborate to help make progress on that front, because it's an important one.
Makes sense. That makes sense. So, you know, all companies that are 162 years old come with great strengths from that longevity and also some legacy things that you probably wish you could change with a magic wand. If you had one wave of the wand to change anything about John Hancock, what would it be?
You hinted at it with the word legacy. We have, you know, as a company that existed well before computer systems even came about, we have a tapestry of old systems. And when, you know, you have ambition to deliver like really high quality customer service, have a strong NPS score, things like that, the tapestry of those old systems can get in the way sometimes. So if I could wave a magic wand and collapse all those old systems into one modern system, that would be it. Having had no magic wand, we're finishing a multi-year, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars investment to collapse a lot of those old legacy systems down. I think we're going from like 14, depending on how you count, 14 or 16 down to two. Wow. Which helps a great deal now as we bring digital solutions. We're only sort of hooking them into two old, you know, two back-end systems rather than 14 or 16 every time we want to bring something new along. So thankfully, we're down to one last conversion as part of that project. So it's mostly behind us. But it is the history can be an amazing blessing, but it can also be a bit of a curse in terms of the, again, the old systems and things that we have. But we've invested a lot to modernize that, and we're near the end there.
That makes sense. I don't think most people are aware, but from what I've seen, many life companies are on the same admin system from when they first bought an admin system ever, which is a long time ago, typically.
I think some people are afraid to go back to those old ones about what they'll find, where there are mistakes or something. Yeah. And, you know, I can tell you it's been an interesting process, you know, literally going back to and converting, you know, 40 plus years of 50 years of systems.
Yeah.
But it's good. And once you, it's painful as heck when you're doing it, but once you're there, it's a much more simple operating environment. You can operate closer to a startup than a 162 year old company.
Yeah. Congratulations on getting through that. So let's turn our focus to your leadership. When you think about what you spend your time on during the day, what are the three most important things that are within your purview and focus?
By far, number one is mission, purpose, values, principles, like really having a noble, worthwhile cause to inform and shape what we're trying to do. Again, I think that's by far number one, because everything else can be kind of hard. And if you believe in what you're trying to do, you plow through that hard work and get great things done. That's number one. Two, certainly innovation. I just can't emphasize enough how this industry has to continue to innovate, both with respect to the products and services, but also how we purchase them. And then third, and they kind of all go hand in hand, I spend a lot just on teamwork, team development, and it really goes a lot with that first one that I said about mission and purpose. It's funny, when we go to hire somebody or I add somebody to the team, there are a lot of smart people around, and thankfully a lot that would be willing to come work for me here. But, you know, finding somebody that's not only technically really strong and experienced, but thinks differently, thinks about that mission and purpose that we have, that doesn't just say intellectually it would be nice if our customers lived longer, healthier lives, but feels it in a personal way. Like, yeah, that's my purpose, is to help people live longer, healthier, better lives. That's driven by innovation, that can see the opportunities. And Peter, for all the progress we've made, you know, you've driven it at Ethos. I'm proud to have driven some at Hancock. You know, there's so much more opportunity for innovation in our industry, as you said, to reach more Americans with our solutions and to continue to innovate on what the offers are themselves, that you've got to have a certain kind of talent, not just smart, not just driven, smart, driven, and a real sense of purpose and desire for meaning and meaningful outcomes for your customers. And frankly, it sounds corny, but for society as a whole.
That makes sense. So your leadership style can often, you know, morph depending on the situation that it's called for and the people who you're focused on working with. But if your team had to describe your leadership style generally, what would they say?
The positives would be visionary, strategic, innovative, you know, passionate. The not so positives would be has a hard time letting go, a bit of a, probably some micromanagement tendencies, and highly impatient, I'm sure would be the first one. Like I'm one of these people that sees the possibility of something and I'm very frustrated that it's not happened within a week. And my team, and good for them for doing so, constantly reminds me that we can't do all these things in 1 week. You need to prioritize and things like that. So I'm very
realistic. That's more of a strength than a weakness. That's like when people say that their weakness is a perfectionist.
Yeah, but it's true. Like I just get very impatient and it can be hard on people, right? You have to recognize that as a leader, particularly when you have people that care about what they're doing and believe in the purpose. Like they don't, I sometimes make it too hard for people to say no, right? And that sounds corny, but sometimes people do need to say, no, Brooks, we can't do all these things. And thankfully I've got a team that will do that, but they would say, hard to tell no to sometimes, but that's good. We end up in a good place.
So what advice would you offer to young professionals who are looking to make a mark in the insurance sector while staying attuned to how the industry is changing and transforming, you know, a lot within the last 5 years and probably will be a lot going forward?
Yeah. First of all, I think it's a great space to be building a career in for both sort of soft reasons and hard reasons. The soft reasons are you'll never find, for somebody who's looking to find meaning in their work, make an impact with their work, you'll never find a space where we can impact people's lives in a more positive way. If you've ever known someone who's died unexpectedly and had life insurance versus someone who's died unexpectedly who hasn't, and it's one of the curses of jobs like ours, Peter, right? Whenever somebody in your social circle dies unexpectedly, you're the person that has to sort of awkwardly ask the surviving spouse, did Joe have life insurance? And having heard both sides of that, you have this passion for having everybody have it that can possibly afford it. And then all the things we're talking about, doing the role the life insurance industry can play in terms of helping people live longer, healthier lives by bringing the latest technology to them. So a huge opportunity to find meaning and purpose there. Then on the sort of harder part of things, for all the innovation that's started to occur in our industry, there's still so much more that can occur. And it's the kind of space you can really play a positive role in disrupting things for the better, whether it's bringing AI to bear, personalization to bear, digital technologies to bear. The industry as a whole is still closer to the beginning of those journeys than the end, where certain other spaces, frankly, are farther ahead. And so I think you can make a huge impact, both sort of the substance of the business, but also just in terms of personal meaning. So, and I would say find that, you know, I talk a lot about what we do. I'm sure you do as well. And people say, geez, you always seem kind of authentic about this stuff. And I'm like, well, gosh, if I can't talk about what we're doing in a way that seems like I mean it, I should go do something else, right? And I would never want to find myself in a position, and I'd urge anyone watching this earlier in their career, don't do a job that you can't find genuine excitement, meaning, purpose, fulfillment around. And, you know, for me, helping people live longer, healthier, better lives, helping them get the protection they need so should something terrible happen so their families are attended to, or even on the wealth and savings products that we offer, accumulate wealth for an enjoyable retirement. Those are like the most profound ways you can impact somebody's life. But if they don't interest you, don't do it. Like, oh, go, you know, if, I don't know, and I don't say this facetiously, you know, saving whales is what excites you. Go be a marine biologist and save whales. Like I don't say that again facetiously at all. That great career, but find that thing that excites you, because we all spend, and Peter, I know how much time you spend at work. We all spend a huge proportion of our lives wrapped into and around our professions. And if you genuinely are excited by it and enjoy it, it just is it's a gift, and you feel awesome about it. Thankfully, I haven't had this, but I imagine if I dreaded what we did or didn't believe in what we did, it'd be a grind. So don't let yourself get caught in the latter of those. Find something that genuinely excites you.
That makes sense. So last couple questions are just to get to know you, Brooks. What's your favorite place to vacation?
Oh, gosh, I do as much travel as I can. Of course, work takes me to interesting places. I love New Zealand.
Yeah.
Costa Rica. I like to fish a lot, so I go big game fishing in Costa Rica. Some love Switzerland. I I'm taking my son to Africa in a few weeks for a safari.
Oh, nice.
But day in and day out, if I could only go one place, it would probably be Hawaii. I love Hawaii, Maui, and the whole Polynesian culture and that kind of stuff. But it's all good. We're lucky to go any of these places. And every place I go, I take as a gift.
It's a hike for you to get out there. It's good commitment.
People always say that, but I last week I was in Hong Kong for 24 hours, and I travel a lot, so Hawaii's really not all that far in the grand scheme of things compared to some travel. But
so, what's the last topic or subject that you went really deep on learning about that didn't have anything to do with life insurance?
Oh boy, I'm sure you're going to mock me for this, and I'll hear from people, but I'm actually quite a bird nerd. I'm really fascinated by birds, and I love spotting and identifying different birds. I've taken my son to interesting parts of the world to find very rare species, and I'm sure no one came to this podcast looking for a movie recommendation, but there's a really cute movie called The Big Year with Steve Martin, Jack Black, and Owen Wilson about these. It's based on a true story of these people that compete to see who can spot the most different bird species in North America over the course of a year. And it's turned a lot of people on to birding. And so anyways, I probably know way too much about birds, way more about birds than I'd care to share with the audience. But I'm quite interested in that.
Well, I remember, speaking of taking your son to Africa, I remember my first safari, very focused on lions and, leopards, et cetera. And after a couple more, by the last one, I was very into the birds. And I noticed that all of the kind of more senior, especially from Britain, folks who are on the safaris, they didn't care about the lions. They just want the birds.
Yeah, you want to watch your back a little more with the lions than the birds, but I hear you.
And the last question is the last book you read.
Oh, gosh. It was about birds. I think I'll leave it at that. It was about birds.
Well, Brooks, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for taking the time. It's just been a really interesting discussion. It's been a pleasure to get to hear how you are innovating so much within life insurance, and really for the benefit of the policyholder and for the advisor, which is just excellent to hear. And congratulations on all your success. And we can't wait to hear more and more about what's coming out of John Hancock and everything that you're doing with Vitality. And we're excited for our collaboration on a product as well together. So
great. Well, thank you, Peter. And congrats on all that you guys have done at Ethos. And I look forward to working together in the future.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Take care. Have a great day. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of What's Your Ethos. If you're interested in helping to protect the next million families, come join us. You can learn more about Ethos at ethoslife.com. I'll see you next time.